This is Jock Talk, an intimate, in-depth discussion with the best jockeys in thoroughbred racing. Presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
25-year-old Mario Gutierrez, who touched Derby, 1:38.
Digging down for the final 16th under Victor Espinosa.
Joe Calamo in the ride of his life, in the race of his life.
Gary Stevens, 3 Preaknesses.
A brilliant ride by Calvin Burrell.
Up the inside under Johnny Velasquez to take it.
Shanghai Bobby and Rosina Pravnik come again to beat. He's had enough.
Raji Barajaboard crushing the field here.
Perfectly ridden by Javier Castellano.
A scintillating performance under Rafael Bejarano.
Now, here's Christina McManigal.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. I am retired jockey Christina McManigal, and I'm joining you from our Lexington, Kentucky studio. I would like to thank everyone listening tonight on Sirius 219, XM 206, and to those of you listening to our website at horseracingradio.net. Now, a portion of the proceeds from this show go to benefit an organization that is so very important to the industry, the Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund. The PDJF provides financial assistance to permanently disabled riders who have given everything to the sport. If you are able to help, please visit the website www.pdjf.org. Now tonight, I am happy to introduce a guest I looked up to so much during my own career. He's ridden all over the world with victories in the Queen Elizabeth, the Delaware Oaks, the Jim Beam, just to name a few. I can't wait to hear his story. With 2,883 wins and over $68 million in earnings, I'm happy to introduce C.H. Marquez Jr. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Christina, I'm very happy that you invited me to your show today, and I'll be answering all your questions the best way I can.
Carlos, thank you so much. It's going to be so much fun. And yeah, we used to ride together back in the day in Maryland, and as I said in the introduction, I looked up to you so much because you just carried yourself with so much class, and you would help out the younger riders in the room, and I want you to know how much I appreciated that back in the day. And Carlos, like I said, I can't wait to hear your story. And the way we usually start these shows out, we usually go back to the beginning. And you are from Puerto Rico. And take it from there, Carlos. Tell us how you got started.
Yes, well, I was born in San Juan in 1967. And it comes from a family of riders. I had my father, uncles, and 2 cousins that rode before. And it just went on from there, like it always, you know, runs in the blood. And I try to follow my father's footsteps the best way I could. And those are hard shoes to fill, but I managed to get maybe a quarter close to what he was as a rider.
He was definitely an excellent rider. He's a legend. And actually, we spoke before, Carlos. You said he was ill, and I'm happy to hear that he's doing well. He's doing better now. Anyway.
Yes, he suffered a little bit from liver, and thanks to God, everything is going positive back the same way. It got real shaky there last month. We thought it was going like the wrong way, but prayers and believing in is getting back to where he knows it, who we are, and you know, and he's much, much, much better than what he was.
That's so good to hear, Carlos. And tell us about your father's highlights during his own career, just so we are aware. Tell us about C.H. Marquez Sr.
Well, C.H. Marquez Sr., he was the leading rider at Keeneland as an apprentice in 1968 in a fall meet. He had I think he won like 22 races. He was a leading rider at Keeneland. He was in the top 10 in almost 10 years of his career. He was in the top 10 in the country. He won 5 races 3 times at Aqueduct. He won 5 races 3 times at Garden State. He rode some major, major good horses. And I don't think if it wasn't for him, I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing right now, because he opened a lot of doors for me and for a lot of Latin Spanish riders, and got to be very appreciative for what he has done.
Wow. Yeah, like you said, big shoes to fill, Carlos. And he actually taught at the jockey school in Puerto Rico. Is that right?
Yes, he was a mentor here for like 3 years, and he accomplished to have some very good riders. And then he decided he wanted to go back to Chicago, where I was. And then he became the first steward in Puerto Rico to be he was the head steward, the state steward here for like 5-6 years. And then he just retired like 2 years ago.
Wow. So what did he say when you first came up to him and you said, "Dad, I want to be a jockey"?
Well, you know, like every father, and you know, and they can't discourage you of what you want to be. They do their best, you know. I mean, a couple of times they say, you know, you could be a lawyer or a doctor or something, but if this is the profession that you want to pursue, I'll be behind you 110%, and here I am.
Here you are, Carlos. That's fantastic. Did you go through the jockey school in Puerto Rico yourself, or did you just learn directly from your father?
Well, he was the instructor in the school, but I was underage. I was only like 14, and to get in the school, you got to be 18 and have the high school diploma, graduation. So I was too young, but I would just go out there and just watch what he teach the other bug boys that they were in the school. And then when he got out of there, that job was done. Then we used to go home, and he went and got me we went and got a screw eye, and we put it on the roof of the house. And we got some shavings and a bag. And then I used to put my feet on a chair. And then he made me say, "Well, you ready to ride a race?" And then he get the stopwatch, and then we're going to run a mile on eighth. He said, "Well, you ready? Let's go." And he hits the time, and he makes me pose and do what I needed to do. And then he said, "Now you're coming down the stretch. Let's see what you got." And then I'm riding, and then sometimes he tells you, "Do you know how far you're going or how fast you're going?" So, you know, I learned a lot of things through that from him.
What a great mentor to have. Your own father is so accomplished himself, and teaching you hands-on like that, that's an incredible experience, I'm sure, Carlos. And so you were only 14. Had you ridden a racehorse at that point?
No, well, I was just getting on the ponies and, like, doing shed row things, you know. I wasn't really going on the racetrack, on the main track. They don't let you, you know.
Right.
But I was managing to do whatever I needed to do to get my fitness and my... It's not the same when you get on a racehorse that when you're doing it on a chair, but at least you have the idea, and then you get your timing, and you know that when you get on a horse, you're not lost. You are, at least you know what to do and where to begin with, you know?
Exactly, exactly. And how old were you when you actually were able to get on your first racehorse?
I rode my first horse. I was 16, like 3 months before I was going to be 17. I rode my first horse at 16.
What was that like? Do you remember that experience, getting the leg up
Yes.
over your first thoroughbred?
I was on an even money horse at Gulfstream Park for Sonny Hines. And, well, before that, I was going to ride a race. And I got cameras, pictures, and everything. And the sad part was that I'm going out to go get on my horse in the paddock, and the horse flipped in the paddock. Uh-huh. And she had to be, you know, euthanized because she kind of broke her neck in the paddock. So when that happened, it like, I didn't want to do nothing. I went home, and I didn't want to even go to the track. It took me like a couple days to get my head to, like, you know, I don't want to do this anymore.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I got back into it, and then I rode my first horse in February at Gulfstream.
That had to be...
it was devastating, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, well, definitely, to have your hopes up, and then the horse flips in the paddock like that, I can't imagine.
Yes, it was devastating, you know, especially when you're young, you're only 16. You don't know. You know, you're like, you're pumped up to do something, and then this happens. Ugh. You know, it was devastating, and it really looked like it was the end of the world. You know, you'd be looking forward for this day that you're going to get to ride your first professional race, and something like this happens. Oh, you know, you get like a little devastated, but, you know, just got to keep going. Heads up and, you know, keep it going.
Keep it going, Kylos. Keep it going. Well, before you actually took out your jockey's license, were you in Puerto Rico galloping horses, or were you in the United States at that point?
No, when I first came to Jersey, I worked for Joey and Beezy for a little bit, and then it got cold, and I was just coming from Puerto Rico, and I couldn't take it. So I went to Florida, and I started working for Sonny Hines, Humbert Sonny Hines, and he was the one that got me going. I was working all his good horses, and then he put me on my first ride.
Wow. Did you seek the advice from your father before you actually took out your license? Did you say, hey, Dad, do you think I'm ready? Do you have any advice?
Yes. Well, for my 16th birthday, he got me a present. My present was that I was supposed to work my first horse from the gate, and he was going to be next to me on another horse for a trainer that, rest in peace, Robert Dorso, Bobby Dorso. Uh-huh. And I didn't know, so 8:30 comes, he said, come on, we got to go to Dorso's barn. And he said, you're going to get on that one, I'm going to get on this one, and we're going to the gate. And we worked the horse 3/4 of a mile out of the gate at Meadowlands. And he was on the inside, and I was on the outside, and I kind of just, you know, I was sitting next to him, and I'm watching him, and he's watching me, and it was a good experience.
That's awesome. That's awesome, Kylos, to have your father, the legend, right next to you, showing you how to do it. And did you ever ride with him in a professional race?
Well, unfortunately, he used to have a lot of weight problem. He used to reduce a lot. And he retired 3 months before I rode my first horse.
Oh, my goodness. So close. So close.
Yeah, but he tried, but, you know, his body just couldn't take it anymore.
Yeah.
You know, when you pull 5, 6, 7 pounds every day, and then you can't feel 100%, 110% when you're out there giving your horse your best at ability to win a race. He said, when that comes, it's time to retire, time to quit.
Did he offer you any advice for controlling your weight?
Well, fortunately, I got my mom's weight, which my mom is like 6 feet tall, and she weighs like 105 pounds, 110 pounds. So thank God that I got that side of my mother, her weight. I got my father's height and my mother's weight.
Well, that works out perfectly then.
So that helped big time, yes.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. Was it... Well, now, was it tough for your father, who had just recently retired and was pretty much forced to retire because he was having difficulties with his weight, was it tough for him to watch you ride your first race and not be able to be out there participating himself?
Absolutely. He like the day before, he was like, he was riding for a long time, but seeing your son that's going to go ride in a race the next day, and he can't be involved or participating in it. It kind of, you know, hurt him a little bit. You could tell, like, he didn't want to show his emotions because he wanted me to go out there and 110%. He didn't want me to be, like, you know, thinking sad that he couldn't make it with me, you know. So he wanted me to be focused on what I'm going to do on the first ride. But, you know, we always talk about it, and that's probably one of the regrets that he's always had, that he could not ride with a race with me before he retired.
Ah, my goodness. Well, at least he was able to watch and coach you along, did he? After you rode your first race there at Gulfstream, did he watch the replay with you and give you some pointers?
Oh, yeah. Well, he still give me pointers till today. I win a race Sunday at Kentucky Downs. And I still got a point. He thought I weighed a little bit too. I win the race, but he said that I rode him with a little bit too much overconfidence. I waited to like the 16th pole before I moved, and he said, "Luckily that your horse turn of foot was quick, even though it was already late in the race." But hey, I get called every day, every other day, he watches very closely till this day.
That is awesome. Still giving you pointers. That's yes. Great. That is great, Carlos. And so take it from your first ride at Gulfstream Park, and were you nervous?
Yeah, well, I'm not going to lie to you. We all get nervous. I mean, it's nervous. It's the adrenaline, you know, something that you've been wanting to do forever, and it's coming true. Dream is coming true. But, you know, post-parade, yes. That, but once you get in the starting gate and they say they're off, everything falls in place, and, you know, you try to do the best you can and the best you know.
Yeah.
Without trying, you know, the main thing is not to try to get yourself in trouble in the first race or make yourself look bad. So you got to try to do the best way you can to get to, you know, to ride the race without getting anybody in trouble and putting anybody in jeopardy.
Exactly. Exactly. And I remember my first race, Carlos, it seemed like it all happened so fast, that first race anyway. And then as you start going along, it slows down a little bit, and you're more aware of, everything slows down. You're aware of everything that's going on. And
Right.
And that first race is definitely a little bit nerve-wracking. But where did you go from Gulfstream, Carlos?
Okay, well, I departed at Gulfstream. We went to the racetrack named Keystone, which is Parks right now. And that's where I win my first race. I rode there during the day, then I was riding in Garden State, which was night racing, and then Garden State closed. We went to Monmouth, and then I was riding the Jersey circuit. I was leading rider at leading apprentice at Garden State, Monmouth Park, Atlantic City, and the Meadowlands in 1985.
Wow, that I don't think that's ever happened before, has it? An apprentice as the leading?
No, not really, but I mean. That year, yeah, I was leading Bogbo in 5 racetracks.
Wow!
Before I went to New York for the winter.
That's quite the accomplishment, Carlos. That's quite the accomplishment. Now, when you were riding during the day at Keystone and at night at Garden State, that is exhausting. And to ride day and night. And how did you do that? Did you have your agent drive you back and forth, or did you work a lot of horses in the morning, or did you tried to sleep in a little bit? How did you do that?
Well, you know, when you're a bug boy and you win in races, everybody wants you. So I was working horses. Sometimes I had to work horses before the break at Parks and then cross over to Garden State because it was like 45-minute drive. Cross over and then go to Garden State and work some over there too. And I had my agent was right there. And, you know, when you're young like that, you really don't feel... You don't get tired because you want to do it. You know, you're pumped. You want to succeed. So you don't even think about being tired.
Now, you were still 16 at this point, yeah, or 17?
I just turned 17.
Okay. So, yeah, you were quite young. And like you said, you have all the energy in the world, especially when you love what you do. And that's what we all have to have, that passion for the industry. As tough as it is and as hard as it is to make it, you have to have that that passion for doing it. And
right.
So you ride in the Jersey circuit and then you go to New York for the winter, is that right?
Yes.
How did you mentioned earlier that you didn't like the cold too much coming from Puerto Rico. How did you adjust to that cold during the winter
at
Aqueduct?
When I started working horses, you know, it's still cold enough, but when you were winning races and at the end of the week, when you got your check and you see that big money coming in, I thought I was in Florida.
That's right. That's right, Carlos.
It's true. You know, I mean, if you're doing good and you're winning races, you're making money, don't get me wrong, it's cold. But you don't think about it as bad as it is. Like if you're not doing any good and you're struggling and you're trying to get going, you know, I've been there. It's difficult. But if you're winning every week and you're doing good, the cold don't really bother you. That's all. It's all mentally, you know.
Like you said, that the paycheck helps a little bit too. What I've heard some riders, give tips for riding in the cold weather, and I know many mornings at working horses at Bowie Racetrack. I remember one particular. It was like 3 degrees, and the horse was lugging out, and I was couldn't feel my fingers. It was just, oh, my goodness. What were some tips that you learned along the way to help you know, keep your hands somewhat warm anyway?
Well, I was ignorant when I was that young, and I used to, like we had Cordero, Migliore, we had Velasquez, Jacinto, we had, you know, back then the big name riders were still riding, they weren't retired yet. So I just kind of, you know, I go around and I kind of ask and look how they operate, you know, don't get too dressed too early before you go out, you know. With the glove situation, some people wear, you know, the surgical gloves, the plastic ones. You put powder in them.
Yeah.
You put them in your hand, and you put the other ones on top. And, you know, things like that. What else? And, like, if you got real cold after you came back from a race, don't put your hands in the hot water because it's worse. Keep it in cold and keep moving your fingers. So your circulation will come back, but that's what happens. You lose your circulation on the tip of your fingers, and that's why it stings. So mm-hmm. you need to keep them moving and put them in cold water, not hot, because the hot will get them worse.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I'm not a fan of the cold weather riding either, Carlos, but good to know some of those tips.
But the coldest for me, coldest was in Chicago when you're riding 20 below. Mm. And the horses got muzzles on them, and they got mustache full of ice. And you have to do, you get on your horse, and you don't have time to warm up, and you go straight to the gate, and you come off, and you get off your horse, and you, when you hit the ground, you feel like you have those needles coming down through you, underneath your feet, and you're walking like you're an icicle.
Oh my God.
That's when I really, really, really felt the cold.
Wow. Yeah, I would say so. I never experienced that. Can't say. Yeah. I'm sad to say I've never had to deal with that cold weather. My gosh, that's crazy. My goodness.
Right.
Joggy C.H. Marquez Jr. joining me on Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. And Carlos, you mentioned some of the bigger names you were riding with in New York at the time, and who were some of those big-name riders who would help you out in the room?
Well, I had the master, Angel Cordero Jr. I had George Velasquez, rest in peace, Donald Macbeth, Robbie Davis, you name him. Who else was there? Who else was that year? Oh, Jim Cruque was there. Rest in peace, Mike Venezia, Eddie Maple, Jean-Luc Samin. I mean, you have some, you know, the top of the cream of the crop were there.
Yeah. Yeah. My gosh, that's quite the crew to be riding with. And what were some of the best pieces of advice they gave you?
Well, the main thing is never override your horse. Put your horse where you need to be, you know, and take care of yourself, take care of the fellow rider. Don't be careless, and go out there and do 110% and win races and be humble and, you know, be open for advice. Don't be like some of the kids right now that you say something and they look at you like, hey, who are you, you know? Mm-hmm. Everything's changed. Everything has changed. It's not the same as it used to be, but what can you do? You just got to keep going, and hopefully they can listen to you once in a while, you know?
No, that's definitely true. And like I said, you were always great in the room helping out the younger riders. And why do you feel it's important to do that?
Why? Because, you know, you see young kids coming up. That's the future, you know? And you see that they have it in them that they could be anything. And you try to help them to get that out of them, you know, to make them better and do the best they can. You know, sometimes they're good, but they never get it out because, they, you know, like the main thing, you got to learn how to speak English. and you don't speak English, you're in trouble. I don't care how good you are. I mean, you can be the greatest, but still, you can still do good. But, you know, if you would done it, if you could do it yourself, it would be better. Having somebody, you know, telling the trainer what I tell him, what I say to him, you know, maybe sometimes he's not telling what I said. So it could be a little conflict, but, you know, that's about it.
Did you speak English when you arrived in the States?
I spoke English because I went to school here.
Oh.
And I went to school in the United States because, see, my dad was riding, so we were here, and we were in Florida. So I went to school in America, so I had that, you know, little bit of that going. So
sure.
On my side.
Sure, you were good to go with that. You were good to go
right.
with that. The younger
right.
riders who don't speak English, do you try to help them with that?
Yes, I mean, you could. You can only say do so much and so much because then they think that you know too much and you're trying to, you know what I mean. So
yeah.
You try to tell them in the best way where they don't get offended or they don't think that you're trying to do it like because you know more than them or something. Because these jocks, these riders that we have now, they're like that. They think that because you're trying to teach them something, that you know more than them, or you don't, you know, it's a big difference. Like from the old days, the old rider will tell you, you should do this, do that, do this. You say yes, sir. Thank you very much. I'll try to perfect myself.
Yeah.
Now you tell these jocks something, and they got something back to say to you.
Mm.
You know, they snap back at you right away. Oh, I'll do this. So you know, right there is telling you that they have their mind of their own.
Right. Right, and then that makes you not want to help them so much after that, right?
I mean, you try to, but when they always get something, when you're trying to correct them and they have always something to say, instead of saying, thank you, sir, I appreciate it that you're helping me, and then even though if it's wrong, then when later on when you walk away, then you over there you might say something, but don't do that when somebody is trying to correct you and leading you in the right way.
Right, right. Well, they should definitely listen to you, Carlos, because you have years of experience under your belt, and we will continue our visit with jockey C.H. Marquez Jr. after this short commercial break. Stay with us. You're listening to Jock Talk presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka here on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Hi, I'm Tito Beveridge, founder and master distiller of Tito's Handmade Vodka, America's original craft vodka. I believe in the craft process of distilling in batches using old-fashioned pot stills, and that's the way we still make Tito's Handmade Vodka today. We even won the World Spirits Competition, double gold, unanimous judge's choice. Tito's Handmade Vodka is made from 100% corn, so it's naturally gluten-free. For recipes, videos, and more, visit titosvodka.com. 80 proof Tito's Handmade Vodka, 5th Generation Inc., distilled and bottled in Austin, Texas.
Being a jockey may be one of the more dangerous professions in all of sports. In a split second, you can go from the top of the standings to never being able to stand again. I'm Mike Penna, and over the years, I've had the privilege of talking with many of the top jockeys in thoroughbred racing. And to a person, they will tell you that on any given day, before any given race, when they get a leg up, there's no guarantee they'll return the way they left. It's simply the reality of being a jockey. The Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund does amazing work, providing financial assistance to some 60 former jockeys who have suffered catastrophic on-track injuries. Since its founding 10 years ago, the PDJF has disbursed over $7 million to permanently disabled jockeys. And I'm proud to say that the PDJF is the official charity of the Horse Racing Radio Network, but the only way they can continue helping those disabled riders who have given our sport so much is through your generosity and support. So I encourage you to visit pdjf.org and start making a difference today.
You're listening to Jock Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka.
Straight Story Mikoshi, still 1-2 as they come to the top of the stretch. Sell the Barber is produced on the outside now for that final quarter mile. From the back of the pack comes Riviera Cocktail and Hudson Steel down inside. At the top of the stretch, Straight Story is a stubborn rival here. Mikoshi is full out, but Mikoshi is still second with one furlong to go as Hudson Steel comes up a big opening down inside. Straight Story in front. Hudson Steel runs at him with a final burst of energy, but Straight Story goes wire to wire to win the Fort Mercy, and he won it by a neck over Hudson Steel.
Welcome back to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. I am Christina McManigal, and I'm joined tonight by jockey C.H. Marquez Jr. We just heard the replay of the 2011 Fort Mercy Stakes, Carlos's victory aboard Straight Story. And Carlos, describe that race.
Well, first of all, the story is that my dad rode Fort Mercy, which that was the name of the stake. That was a great horse. He was like horse of the year two or three times.
Wow.
And the race was, I rode for Alan Goldberg. And the horse always, you know, he's always been showing speed. So we talked to the race and he said, no, if you can go, you go. If not, you can stalk and do whatever you need to do. So we left the gate. I went to the front, and I just kind of rode in as best I could. And then I'm still waiting. We turned for home. There was a horse trying to come through on the inside. And when I asked my horse, he went to running, but he was the horse inside was game. And my horse just barely went. He went by like a neck or a head, something like that.
How cool is that, that your dad rode Fort Mercy? That had to mean so much whenever you captured that victory aboard Straight Story, the fact that your dad rode that horse.
Yes, it was a big thing. I got the picture here at home. My dad on Fort Mercy, he went the Stars and Stripes at Arlington.
Wow, that's what a great story. And there's also, you also have a similarity with your dad as far as you won the Black Eyed Susan Stakes in 1997. Your father also won the Black Eyed Susan Stakes. Tell us about that.
Yeah, my dad won the Black Eyed Susan in 1970. For Buddy Lemon, the filly was named Office Queen. And with that filly, after that race, he won the Mother Goose at Belmont with her. And then I managed to win the Black Eyed Susan at Pimlico in 1997. And we got back to the winner's circle. It was, you know, I was like emotional. It was a father and son winning the race 20-something years later.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think it hasn't been done yet since. So,
no.
I mean, to me, that was a big, big accomplishment.
Of course. Of course. Was your dad there or was he watching?
Yeah, he was there. And the only thing was that when my dad went, it was 75. And when I went, it was 250.
Oh. You lucked out in that one. Your poor dad. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, but 70, that kind of money back in those days, it was big money. You know?
Sure.
But, you know, still, it's like how everything has changed, you know, the money-wise, you know. Many of those great jocks, with the money they have now, how much money would they have made? You know, it's a big difference.
Right. Oh, exactly. The purses have definitely gone up since back in the day. Now, you rode in the Derby in 1997, is that right?
Yes.
And tell us about your mount in the Derby, Carlos.
Okay, well, I was riding this horse for John Tamayo Concerto, owned by George Turnbrenner. He went very impressive at the Brookies meeting at Belmont. And then what made everything, even that he was going to be a good horse, was when we win a little stake at Meadowlands, and I'm laying third, and he made the lead like around the eighth pole, and he bolted like to the middle of the outside. I don't know if something spooked him, and like two horses went by him. It looked like he was a beat horse, and I don't know what I did or what happened, and I kind of cocked his head to the left, and he saw the horses inside of him, and he come back, and he ran by those horses like they weren't even in a race.
Wow. Bolted and still won.
And then he did it again. When I win the Count Fleet at Aqueduct, he did it again. Mm. Not as bad. So then we went to We went to Turfway, and he did it in the Battaglia, which was the prep for the Jim Beam. Mm-hmm. And then Mr. Tamaro said, well, we got to change equipment. So he put a big old shadow road, the biggest one you can see anywhere. And he never did it again.
Never did it again. Well, that worked out good then. Wouldn't want him doing that in the Derby with how many horses?
There was like, I would have been very careful because you don't even know, you know, he could go either way, that way or that. He could go either right or left. So,
oh my goodness.
You know, you have to be prepared for that.
Wow. How did he run in the Derby?
Well, then we run him in the Derby and, you know, we had some instructions. Like, you know, the horse has always been, he was better like if he saw a horse in front of him stalk, you know. Because we didn't want to give him no excuse that if you go to the front, he starts doing all by himself, then he's waiting for horses, and he starts looking with all the crowd, and he might do one of those little tricks that he wanted to do. So then everything changed, and Mrs. Steinbrenner wanted him up close to the pace. So I tried to leave there running, and I couldn't get. So I was laying third, going to the first turn, very happy. I was having the greatest trip ever. We got to the past the half, 3.8, 3.5. I said, I saw everybody creeping up. I said, you know, let me just maintain my position and, you know, nudge on him a little bit to stay where I am. And he did. I said, well, if he kicks from here, you know, we're all right. And then, you know, we turned for home, he switched leads and he went out a little bit and then he kind of got a little late. You know, everybody came running, you know, Silver Charm, Captain Budget, you know.
That had to be a
Treehouse.
That had to be a great experience, though, just to be there, just to walk out onto the track, you know, while they're playing My Old Kentucky Home. That had to be a great experience.
Absolutely. I mean, if there's a jock that I don't care if they roll 1, 2, 3, 4, and when you go down that tunnel and they start playing My Old Kentucky and the pony boy is going to grab yours, if you don't get goosebumps or tears comes out of your eyes, you're not a human being. I mean, it goes right through you.
Yeah, I could.
You try to block it, but there's no it managed the way to slip in somewhere.
Yeah, wow. Jockey C.H. Marquez Jr. joining me on Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Carlos, you also, not only did you ride in New York and Chicago and New Jersey and Florida and all over the United States, you also rode internationally.
Yes.
Tell us about
what. I went to Saudi Arabia for 10 days to ride a horse. I came back. And then I was at the Meadowlands, and there was a jock named Alex Beitia that he just came from Macau in China, and his contract was up. So I was just, you know, teasing him because you need to be invited. They go by your past performance, your earnings, your wins, your great ones. So I said, hey, man, what do you think if I can go over there? He said, we can apply and see what they say. So he got me an application. We signed it all right there at the Jackson at Meadowlands. We went back to the hotel right there, and we faxed it to them. Mm. So he said, well, you get a response like in 2 days. Well, the front desk called us like 30 minutes later. Hey, you got an email here. So we looked at it. They accepted my application, and they wanted me to be there like in 3 weeks.
Wow. They said, yes, okay.
Wow, I said, what am I going to do now? I was just teasing, and then I said, you know, now what? I said, well, I guess I got to go. I mean, this is an opportunity of life that not too many people get to do that. So I ended up going overseas. I went there on the same year of 9/11, but I left in November.
Wow.
And so I was there from November to June. It was a quiet experience. I mean, you had to learn a lot, language and riding. You know, you don't go like we do here. We go clockwise over there, you know, the wrong way, and you have to adapt to all that. So So it was quite an experience.
How are the other riders there? How is it to ride with a whole group of different people who didn't speak English, and how was it in the room? How was it?
Well, believe it or not, those Chinese jocks and their Asian jocks, they don't ride like we do. You know, we are aggressive. We want to do this. We're going to. They ride straight. They just worry about winning and, you know, getting to the wire first. They're not like over here, like where we ride competitive, aggressive, mm-hmm. like, you know, not tight. Yeah, you're not going to come inside. If you're going to go out, some jocks will drift. You know, they make it impossible.
Right.
Over there, everybody's on your own, and the best horse wins.
Really?
Yes.
No kidding. And it was, you're going the wrong way. Was it mostly grass racing?
Yes, everything was turf. Everything was turf, and I had to adjust. They caught the second day. I win the first six horses I rode. I win, and then they call me in the seventh run. I run third. The stewards call me in because, you know, it's a different action over there. I was riding with my American style. You know, mm-hmm. hit one hand ride, hit one hand ride. But over there, you got to use your legs, you know, like you hit them with your heels and then you fan your whip. It's not like we do, you know, we bring it up and down, bring it up and down.
Yeah.
They hit with the whip down, you know, Australian style, like English, you know, you kind of. So they told me that I had to adjust to that and cut my whips, but my whips were too long.
Really?
Yeah.
And how is that? I've seen the English riders, and they move a lot more. Like you said, they're digging in with their heels, and it's a totally different way of riding. So you had to adjust to that style. That would be very difficult, I would think.
Well, I told the stewards, I said, gentlemen, I've been riding 30 years. By that time, was like maybe 20. I said, I've been riding for so long. This is my style. I know I came to a different country to ride. You have to give me a little bit to adjust to your style because it's not going to come overnight.
Yeah.
So I started working horses in the morning. You know, I dropped my irons down. You got to drop your irons down. And then I had my whips were like 24 inches. I had to get them cut off and learn how to, you know, swing and kind of push and swing and use the heels. So working horses in the morning helped me a lot. And like when you ride with your stirrups in the United States, your right is high and then your left is short, mm-hmm. is longer. So over there is the opposite.
Oh.
Short left and then long on the right because you're going around the other way. So it took me, but once I got to it, it was quick.
Yeah, that seems, just to imagine that, Carlos, like you said, we all ride AC/DC over here, but to reverse that seems just weird, and I don't know how I would be able to get used to that. I'm sure it took some time to adjust to a completely different riding style in a way. Now, you mentioned working horses in the morning. Over there, is it the same way? You have an agent, and you go out and you basically...
No.
No.
No, you don't have an agent there. They give you a list. The trainers that want you to ride their horses will call you. All the horses got numbers on their saddle towel. And all the trainers are out there, and the jocks are on one side. And then the guy come look at you and say, you, Marquez, yes, number 265. So you go over there and get on that horse, and then he'll tell you what to do. And that's how we got on the horses. You know, it's not like you have an agent that you got to work horses for everybody.
Really?
Yeah.
That's completely different. That's, wow. And how was it living there, actually living there? Did you live close to the track, or how was that?
Well, over there, all the jocks live in one building, one high rise. The trainers in another one. Everybody's different. You don't see nobody. The jocks live all together, like in different floors. And like the day of the race, you had to be there. You had to check in the morning before.
Really?
You had to stay in the room all day, the day before, because, you know, they gamble there and they bet big money. So they protect their fans. So for the jocks to not have contact with nobody out there, you had to sleep in the jocks room the day before to ride the next day.
Wow. So they just want you isolated. You can't talk to anyone. So
anyone.
Wow. That's interesting. That's it. And you stayed there for how long?
I got there in November and I was there till June.
And why did you decide to leave and not stay there?
Well, I decided to leave because that's when we found out that my dad was sick. Mm. And since I'm the oldest of the three, and he was real bad, so that's why I called and I breached my contract. And I said, look, I'm sorry. I love it here. I would like to stay here. But, you know, I'm the oldest of three, and my dad is very ill, and I need to get home as soon as I can. So I came back to the United States.
And did you go back to Chicago?
Yes, I came back to Arlington. That was 2003.
And that's where you are currently riding, yes, Carlos?
Yes, I'm riding in Arlington right now, yes.
And I've never ridden there. How is it, and you've done so well in Chicago, how is it riding the Arlington?
It's wonderful. You know, when I used to, I rode there when they had a dirt and turf. Now they got the poly track. So my last year in Chicago was 2006. In 2007, they put the poly track, and then I didn't go back to Chicago until 2014. So in the last 2 years that I've been there, you know, I got, you know, used to the poly track, and the turf is the greatest. So, you know.
How is it different riding on the poly track versus dirt?
Well, it's very different because, first of all, you don't know how fast you're going on the poly track because you don't even feel your horses hit the ground.
Mm.
Okay?
Yeah.
And you got to adjust to it because it fools you. You think you're going fast, you think you're going slow, and you're flying. and when it rains, it's vice versa. You think you're going fast, but you're going slow. Mm. So it's a big difference from, you know, I never rode it to there, so.
So you have to adjust your inner clock, basically, which is something that jockeys have to work on, you know, prior to riding. They have to get that clock in their head. They know how fast they're going. And so to go from you're used to riding on the dirt, you have a clock in your head for the dirt, but then you go to poly track and it's completely different. That had to be difficult to adjust to.
It is. You have to adjust to that timing because it's a big difference.
And how about the track bias? Does it favor speed or does it favor the closers or how is that?
Well, since you know that track is like rubber, you have to see how the temperature is. Believe it or not, how the temperature is, because the hotter it is, the faster it gets.
Mm.
So you look at the temperature and you watch a couple of races and you see, it's like anything. I mean, usually speed helps, but if you ride the best horse in the race, I think you can overcome that. Other than that, you know, just like I said, you got to be careful because of the weather change. It could go from when you're going 21:44 to going 23:47, like in an hour.
Wow, that's a big difference. That's a big difference.
Yes, it is.
How about Kentucky Downs? You said you just recently shipped down there to ride. Had a very successful time down there. How was it riding on the track there?
Well, for me, I like it because I've been very successful on it. I rode six horses. I went three races. I had a second and third. I walked the turf. You know, the surface is perfect. It's good. The only problem is, you know, you got to go around sharp turns, and you got to go uphill, downhill, and make a turn, and then go back up to the old hill and back down. So, you know, your horses got to help you. You know, you can tell right away when your horse is going to handle that kind of surface or not. When you're warming your horses up and you're going up down the hill and the surface is, you know, funny, you can tell who's gliding to it and who's not.
With that kind of the up and down and the tight turns, you have to have an advantage given the fact that you rode in Hong Kong, Macau, and you had so much experience on the grass over there. Is it a little bit similar to that?
Well, a little bit. But, you know, like for the people that I rode for, Like, I win a couple races for the Russian, Mr. Babachenko. You know, those horses, to me, that racetrack there is stamina because you go up and down hills and you go fast, slow down, fast, you slow down. So I think the best horse, they got the best stamina there and overcomes liking the track. You're okay.
You have to kind of just give the horse their head so they can navigate the up and down track?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. I learned that from Mr. Joe Pierce, Mr. Pierce. Horses, you take a long hold and you drop their head and they're going to bobble and they're going to come back up. And he mentioned something to me. When the weanlings and babies are turned out in the farm, when they get away from the mommies, and there's 10, 15 of them running up and down those hills in Kentucky and everywhere down, they're flying. And you don't see them bobble or stumble or nothing like that. It's the same thing like when you're a race.
Yeah.
You just take that long hold and you let them come up and down. Don't fight them. And that's what I do.
You got to trust them that they'll find their own way, you know?
Right.
Joggy C.H. Marquez Jr. joining me on Jock Talk tonight, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Carlos, what's the nicest horse you've ever ridden?
Well, I rode some very nice ones. I rode Skip Away. I rode The Hoss.
Wow.
I rode Former Gold. I rode Include. I rode Concerto. I mean, I rode Vaquero, who gave me my first grade one. I rode a horse named Lost Mountain, who won the Haskell for La Blavi. Mm. You name ridden some pretty good horses.
Quite the resume, Carlos. And you can't really, it would be difficult to pick one out of the list of names you just mentioned. Definitely. Tell me about Vaquero, the horse that won the grade one Queen Elizabeth. Tell me about that race.
Okay, well, Chris Black, he's been one of my number one, how do I say this? He gave me to ride every horse that he has in his barn. He's been my number one customer since I ever started riding. Very, very loyal to me. And he asked me, you want to work this filly? I need her to be slowed down. She's very aggressive, and they let her go too fast, and I need you to try to see what we got. So I worked her, and I fall in love with her. I said, Chris, you got a nice, special filly here. Mm. So we kept working her, and I got her matched to where we want her. She went first time out. She paid like $86.
Wow.
And then she went to the Queen Elizabeth undefeated. She went to puck her up, and then she ran into Keelan the Gray One, and, you know, there were some big names in that race and great horses, and she managed to stalk where I wanted it, and when I asked her to run, she kicked on, and she went by a length and a half, and that was my first Gray One win.
Wow. That had to be a special moment. And was your dad there for that one?
No, he was in Chicago because I had to fly. That was at Keeneland, and the next morning I had to fly back because I had to ride at Hawthorne. And when I got there, they lost my luggage.
No.
They lost everything.
Oh, my. And they never found it.
Well, they found it, but 2 days later they brought it back.
Oh, my gosh.
I had to go to Midway and go pick it up.
Oh, my goodness. What did you do in the meantime? All your tack was lost.
Well, I was supposed to ride one horse in the second race, but you know how it is. You win. You just get done winning a $500,000 race, grade one. You show up. If you don't show up to ride the next race, then people get, oh, he win. He make all this money. He ain't going to, you know, he ain't going to. Yeah. So I made my attempt. I went all the way there. I went to the room, and I explained to them, look, my tack is gone, and I don't want to. I wanted to use my own equipment. I don't want to use nobody else's stuff.
Right, right. I couldn't do that either. Just to,
you know what I mean.
Yeah.
So that was the end of that.
And they didn't talk about you even though because you tried you did.
Well,
attempt.
you know the racetrack. You know they always got something negative to say.
Yeah, you know.
But I blocked it off and went on and did what I needed to do, and here we are.
Here we are, Carlos. What's next? You're riding the Chicago circuit right now. Where are you heading to next?
Well, I'm going to Hawthorne for a month, and then I got a couple offers, fairgrounds, away to Oakland. So I'm undecided. I got to make a decision and see. I have a great agent, Jim Ernesto. He's done a great job for me. So we have to talk about things, and then we'll go from there.
Carlos, tell our audience how important having a good agent is.
Well, they want the jock. The jock is the product. If you don't have a good product, you cannot sell it. So when the product is there, the agent sells that product to all the trainers and on. And when you have an agent that knows how to place his horses where they don't get mixed up, like if you have two horses in the same race, and they can manage to get them one here, one over there, and they stick by you, and they talk to the trainers, and they do just about everything to get the horses in the right race to win races, that's when an agent is. And good communication with your agent helps a lot.
Well, of course, and it's sometimes hard to find a good agent who will work so hard for you. So it's great to hear that you have a great agent working for you. It's so important to have a good team. And Carlos, question for you. You have a son, I remember, in Maryland, and he seemed pretty interested in following in your footsteps. And give us the update on that.
Well, I got my baby. He's 13, Charlie Marquez. He's win, I don't know how many, like 15, 17 amateur races with the Little Ponies at Fairhill. Timonium, Laurel, Pimlico, and he's working for Miss Elizabeth Q, and he goes over there on Saturdays and Sundays, work with the horses and the farm, and as of right now, he's going in the right way, and to me, he looks like a natural, but, you know, he might be getting a little tall, but it happens. We'll see what happens in the next year or so.
Well, folks, keep an eye out for Charlie Marquez and the programs. Carlos, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
The pleasure is mine, and anytime that you need me, I'm here to have another great interview again.
Thank you so much, Carlos. Wishing you all the best. Folks, if you missed any portion of tonight's show, check out the website, horseracingradio.net and Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes. Be sure to join me next Tuesday at 6 o'clock Eastern Time with another edition of Jock Talk presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. For our producer, Lee Della Pina, I'm Christina McManigal, and thank you for listening.